Connecting our city and South Cambridgeshire. Cambridge 105 Radio.
What's it like? Condicious.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour with Alan Alder, Sue Bailey and myself, Matt Bentman. And thanks to Ollie Slack for the last hour. Now we move from the chill of the playing field to the warmth of the kitchen.
And on today's programme, we continue our series in which we find out about the food on offer at Cambridge colleges. Today it's the turn of Clare College. We also examine some of the broader issues around food.
Yeah, we look at a few of the food-related activities being undertaken by the council, as well as local food and drink producers, to bring the many benefits of food to local people and to limit the harmful ones.
And we'll be hearing about the ideas for reducing food waste, helping people to eat more healthily by improving their cooking skills, and getting some ideas to help people grow their own food. And in our news section at the end of the programme, we will have some details about this year's Eat Cambridge Food and Drink Festival. So, we are live, as ever, in Gwydir Street Studio. You can contact us by texting 07919 070 490, or you can email us anytime on flavour@cambridge105.co.uk, or send a tweet at flavour105.
And we'd be very pleased to hear from you. Sue went to Clare College last Friday to talk with Lee Cork, the college's catering manager, and she started by asking him if he's noticed an increase in students' interest in food over recent years.
Yes, I have. They're looking for new ideas, as you know, food at the higher end of the scale. I think College Catering Cambridge has never had the best reputation for being a bit sort of meat, potato, three veg kind of thing. But we totally changed that. And we used to silver serve a lot of the food in formal halls. Now it's all plated, portion controlled. And, you know, we do lots of exciting things with the vegetables and potatoes as well. So it's just not, say, roast potatoes, blocking florets or baton carrots.
Can you tell me more about what's a sort of typical day menu for students?
Well, say, for instance, a formal hall, typical menu would be, starter would be celeriac and chestnut risotto with Cambridge blue cheese and pea shoots, and that would be a vegetarian option as well. So kind of fits a lot of people. Main course would be braised bavetta beef, mashed potato, field mushroom, grilled tomato with a peppercorn sauce. And dessert would be rhubarb cheesecake, burnt orange and orange sorbet.
And so how often are the formal halls?
So formal halls we have Monday to Friday.
You mentioned about the historic menus.
Yes.
So historic menus in
yeah,
Clare, that's
yeah.
quite an interesting one.
Yes.
Do you have access to records?
I do. We have them in the archives, yes, and I've looked at them before several times. We had to provide a history of Cambridge dinner a couple of years ago, so we archived the menus from back in the 16th, 17th and 18th century and looked at various dishes, what were on there, and we replicated a couple of them, but in a modern style.
Was there anything that surprised you about them?
It was the Clare mush. I think everyone's heard of, or most people have heard of Eton Mess, but actually the dish originated at Clare College as a mush. And then someone took that dish to Eton and then they renamed it, changed one of the ingredients and called it Eton Mess. We do have that in our archives as well.
How interesting. And what is a Clare mush exactly?
Well, it is basically meringue, cream and fruit all sort of chopped up and mixed up together.
And what date was that?
That was in the 17th century, I believe. Yeah.
A mush or a mess? That's very interesting.
Yes.
There's some change in terminology.
Yes. Eton Mess sounds a bit nicer than Clare mush.
It does,
if I'm honest.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And were there any other sort of unusual meats, for example? Did you come across swan or anything?
No, there was a lot of game and sort of mutton, brisket on the menus. We did like a braised beef dish to replicate a dish that they'd served in the 18th century on the Cambridge and History dinner.
What about all the new challenges, if you like, in catering? Things such as halal, gluten-free, different allergies and so on, and rising veganism. What about this?
Yes, well, we have students from diverse backgrounds and a lot of foreign students, and we cater for them accordingly. We offer halal, we offer vegan food. In fact, now in the butchery, we have a vegan choice every day. And a vegetarian choice, a meat choice and a fish choice. When I first started, we just used to offer vegetarian. But there's been such an increase in the requirement for vegan food, so we've had to adjust accordingly to that.
Is that just over the last year or the last few years?
I think it's more over the last 3 years, really.
Mm.
And I'd say our uptake on food in the butchery is 45% will have the vegan and vegetarian option and 55% have the fish and meat option. We've seen a real increase from about 20% up to the 45% over the last 3 years.
And of course you can be a non-vegetarian but think, oh, actually I really fancy...
Well, actually, yeah, and that's what a lot of people do nowadays. They think they're going to cut out meat or... We don't offer a lot of ruminant meat, you know, beef or lamb in the butchery, but often people think, I like the look of that vegetarian or vegan dish, I'm going to try that for a change.
That brings me on to research in terms of developing new menus and new dish ideas.
Yes.
What's the process for you for that?
So what we do with the head chef and the senior sous chef and the sous chefs, they are constantly looking at sort of TV programmes, they're looking on the internet, you know, websites of dishes. We get the hotel and caterer, which may have some ideas there. And then our chefs go along to competitions as well, and that's always a good venue to see dishes or new ideas that are being produced by chefs in the industry. You know, at one point everyone was doing sous vide cookery, but certainly here we've gone back to cooking things more naturally, giving it a bit of caramelization on the meat as well and slow cooking it in the oven. Sous vide is basically boiling the bag, and it's very good for some things. However, when you're cooking meats, it doesn't have the same sort of texture or feel, so we've gone away from that now.
And then how does the final dish make it onto the menu? Is it just tasted within the team?
It is, but usually the dishes are trialled on a Wednesday night for the fellows when they have the sort of more formal high table. For instance, this term now, dishes are getting trialled at the moment. The menus will be put together in the beginning of March and then they'll be ready in May to use. We trial all dishes. There would never be a dish that goes on a menu that no one's ever put together before, because that would be insane, really. So they're all tried and tested, and then we'll go down and look and taste the dishes, and I can get involved as well and offer some advice as well.
And do you repeat dishes on the menu? So say every month there's a sort of, so it goes in a cycle?
We do. The menus are on a six-month cycle. The conference menus, the formal halls change termly. A dish we've had on probably for about 6 years is a chocolate fondant, but we just change really what we offer with it, whether it be a different fruit or a different sorbet or ice cream or puree with it. But chocolate fondant, I don't think we'll ever take off the menu.
No, and if you've got a winner, then stick to it.
Exactly, yeah, that's right.
Can you tell me a bit more about the staff that you have, about, you know, your team, your brigade,
yes,
and about the kitchens?
Yes, certainly. Our team, they come from, a lot of them are from Europe, Hungary, Italy, France, and we have about 14 chefs in the kitchen. We have about 9 full-time people in the front of house operation. And we do, when we have a lot of functions on, we have sort of casual workers waiting on staff. That's usually people doing A-levels at sixth form. So we've always been quite lucky that we've managed to get good level of staff to meet our requirements as well.
And have you found that the sort of profile has changed? I mean, women in the kitchen, is it a fairly male-dominated kitchen or is it fairly mixed?
At the moment, we've only got one female in the kitchen who's working as a pastry chef. In the past, we've had up to 2. It still tends to be a male-dominated sort of profession. You know, if someone applied and they've got a good repertoire behind them, whether male or female, we will employ as we see fit.
And what about training? What do you offer for staff?
Yes, we offer lots of training. Going back to sort of the increase in vegans, we've sent a lot of chefs on vegan workshops that will help them sort of broaden their horizons and looking at new ways to sort of come up with dishes. We offer health and safety training. Anyone who wants to further the skills, they can go and attend an advanced cookery-related course at the Cambridge Regional College. We invest in our people heavily. Here at Clare, we probably are one of the busiest colleges in external business.
Tell me a little bit more about how you came to be catering manager here. What's a bit about your background, please?
I went to college for 2 years. Then I worked in hotels in Liverpool for a period of about 8 months. And then I walked past a careers office, HM Forces careers office in Liverpool. And I then, 4 months later, I joined the RAF and I served in the RAF for 22 and a half years. I could have stayed on longer if I wanted to, but I decided it was time for me to move on, try something new. I found out about the job being advertised at Clare and I applied for it. I got down to the last 3 on the interview panel and then here I am. So, yes, I got the job here.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and I've been here 8 years now.
And so you were involved on the food side in...
In the REF, yeah. I joined as a chef, yes. And then as I got further up the ranks, it was more admin-based office sort of job.
Mm. But again, that gives you experience of banqueting and large scale.
Yes, indeed, definitely, yeah. And I've cooked for royalty in my time as well.
Thank you very much, Lee.
Thank you, Sue.
Well, I didn't know about Claire Mush. So, along with Trinity Burnt Cream, Cambridge has made some important contributions to the world's cuisine, Sue.
Oh, I think it has. And, you know, all these people in other places taking the ideas from us. Cambridge started it. Why not?
Well, many Cambridge cafes and restaurants are concerned about the environmental impact of food. Cambridge Cookery and Bistro takes this further than most, and they have a zero-waste policy, for example. Tina Roche talked about their approach to Alan earlier in the week.
I'm often asked what I mean when I say responsibility and sustainability, and for me, I think it sort of goes local first, small scale, close second, and organic third. Those three are all very important, but I would say in that order. And so consequently, we're getting everything that we possibly can from COFCO, who are currently a sort of clearinghouse for all the small organic producers around Cambridgeshire. And that goes down to Audley End Kitchen Garden, to tiny producers who may only grow one thing. And we get as much as possible as we can from them. We have then also tried to reduce our own waste, as you know. So it occurred to me that there was a waste in this process where, when the produce is no longer looking like supermarket produce, shiny, super fresh, glossy, then a lot of customers don't want it any longer. So there is waste in this beautiful, organic, locally grown stuff as well. And normally it's just given away to farmers and they can give it to their pigs. So my thinking was, well, what about us making something nice from it instead? And it sort of solved two problems. It meant that tens of kilos of good produce weekly wasn't going to be waste anymore, and it comes to us instead. And then in our process of reducing our own waste, we had got down to so very little that we could use at the end of a week that we couldn't really do anything very proactive with it. So we now add our own modest amount of waste to the tens of kilos of waste that we're getting in. And then we cook 30 meals for Jimmy's homeless shelter every Friday. So that's been incredibly positive for us because it solved our own sort of little problem of how to get rid of maybe a kilo and a half of waste that we couldn't think of anything to do with. It's using what is still beautiful, nutritious, locally grown, you know, small producers who sorely need the business. It reduced that area of waste as well. So it was just thinking outside the box a little and increasing the amount of waste in order to be able to decrease it completely.
Right. So you're saying to COFCO, anything that's looking, you know, unsellable,
and that's quite a lot.
We'll deal with it.
Yes.
Oh.
Absolutely, yeah.
So
my only worry is that the crates upon crates of sometimes, you know, slightly sprouting onions or beautiful cabbages are starting to go slightly yellow at the edges, are being carried through our cafe and then into the kitchen. So I'm very keen for people to understand that why we're getting this and what we're doing with it. And then there's a whole load of others that we, you know, we pay for. That is what we make food from when, when we're selling it. Mostly, apart from Fridays, which is our leftover as well.
What happens on Fridays?
Well, so we're open two evenings a week. On Fridays, we're open as a wine bar with a massive amount of beautiful food and on big platters on the counter and then plated up on small plates. So we call it tapas, but it's not really tapas in the Spanish sense of the word. And that is our leftovers. So we're using up, you know, we're looking through everything that's in-house. So we might have a lovely North African roasted cauliflower salad with pomegranate seeds and a yogurty dressing. We try not to buy anything in for Fridays. We make fresh breads always for Friday nights, but the rest that goes out and that tends to be devoured, we're eaten out of the house most Fridays, is actually leftovers in a positive sense, yes.
And what sort of things are you making for Jimmy, sir?
Oh, big pasta bakes, obviously, soups, but they also get treats. So last week we had fewer buyers of our handmade croissants, so we just bag them up when, you know, they go stale quite quickly, fresh breads. So if they've been out on the counter for a couple of hours, they haven't sold, then they have become waste, sadly. So we bag it up, we freeze it, and so we had about a dozen of these beautiful croissants. So out they came again, and we made a bread and butter pudding, but, you know, with a bit of cream and egg yolk and our handmade croissants, and we ended up with two amazing trays of beautiful-looking croissant and butter pudding.
Yes,
and
well,
and
I've
so they had
that. that, and it is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it's delicious.
Isn't it?
Yeah. So it's a little bit of this and that, but mainly, of course, it's bulked out with our own pastas, our own grains, pearl barley, green lentils, rice, whatever it is. You know, we found that we're all incredibly fond of sort of fruit-based curries. Because we were looking at what was left over and what one could put in a curry that wasn't necessarily the obvious thing. So, yeah, it's healthy and very, very sort of tasty food, but perhaps not always with the ingredients that you assume would be in it.
Yeah. And I'm interested to know how you manage to get very little waste. Are you using parts of foods that maybe people would generally throw away?
Yeah, I guess we do. So we have a very holistic approach, and we, you know, consequently also have a very spotless sort of kitchen, because things are cleared out all the time and it just lined up, and we're looking at it and asking ourselves what we can do. So, for instance, if you like carrot cake and you want to make a nice carrot cake, you could actually use turnips or parsnips instead. That works very well as well. They have an inherent sweetness in them, and you'd be pushed to notice the difference, actually. We love using carrot tops, particularly in the season when carrots are very small and new and fresh. Carrot tops go on top of the salads. We do. I suppose that at the end of the day, the only thing that we absolutely can't recycle or use are the eggshells. And we are heaving with our brunch service most days, and the weekends particularly. So we do produce a lot of eggshells because we do a lot of scrambled eggs, poached eggs, omelettes. But apart from that, most things can be used in a very delicious way. You know, we're not talking frugal, boring food here. It's all delicious. Mm. It's just having a different approach.
What about things like a thing that most people, I guess, throw away is the leaves and the stems from cauliflower. Would use those? I think they're delicious.
Oh, delicious.
I think the central rib and a cauliflower leaf is so sweet and crunchy.
Yes, I think perhaps just sort of trying things like that rather than assuming they're going to be chopped off and go straight into a bin or a compost heap. Mm. They're often, as you say, they taste pretty much like the other end of them, don't they? Whatever's at the other end that we're used to eating.
So what would you use something like that for?
Well, you know, you can use those pretty much like we do, say, cavolo nero or any greens that we love, stir-frying them at a high heat as well. Or they go on raw in salads, just like raw cauliflower is really delicious. So are the green bits. But stir-frying with a bit of chilli and garlic and a bit of lemon juice, or, you can use Seville oranges because they're in at the moment. I would say just try it. The worst that can happen is that you cook something that you think perhaps wasn't great, but edible, or you may be lucky and think that, oh, this is absolutely delicious.
Yeah. Do you have what I'd call, I don't know, byproducts? So, for example, if you're boiling something, do you always use the liquid as a stock for something else?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, we make our own stock anyway. So that is, again, is one of those things that have, unbelievably gone completely out of fashion, if you like, because you are using ends of carrots, bits of leek, the root bits, half an onion, etc. So we are making our own stocks anyway, and then we make risotto with them, or we make soups with them. So yeah, of course you can use the water from almost anything that's been simmering and boiled, because it will have picked up that flavor.
Right, so there's a lot of saving that can be done.
A huge amount. Becomes almost a sport, in that once you're into the swing of thinking of it as a cyclical, or someone used the word chasing one's own food, one's own meals, for we can eke out yet another something out of this. It's actually great fun, in a way. Mm. You end up feeling rather smug at the end of the week.
Maybe you should write a book. Maybe you should write a book or...
Smug cooking, do you think it would take?
Great idea.
Smug cooking, a really nice idea. That was Tina Roche from Cambridge Cookery in Bistrick.
A few years ago, when Fitzbillies ran an evening restaurant, which I still miss, by the way, I asked Tim Haywood about some items on the menu they'd just adopted. And what struck me was how so little was wasted, because the byproducts of one dish were often used to make another. So here's some examples.
We don't do chips here, and we wanted to do a kind of potato that was very exciting. So a while back, we started parboiling our potatoes in the stock in which we do our ham daily. So it's a tasty ham-filled stock with a smoky element to it, and it's just delicious stuff. You don't want to see it go to waste. And so we boiled potatoes in there, Then we roll them in an enormous amount of hot duck fat and fry them in the hot baker's oven. And we thought for a really long time about branding these things as baker's potatoes, because that's a lovely sounding thing. It's all sort of healthy and it's got heritage, and it's so Fitzbillies, it's lovely. And I remember in meetings when we said this stuff, and the staff would insist on calling them hammy potatoes. And they're delicious. The staff, we can't make enough of them.
But one of the things I misread when you first showed it to me, Tim, is the Chelsea bun. I'd read it as Chelsea bun ice cream with bun crisps, but it's actually Chelsea bun ice cream.
Oh, yes. Oh, gosh. And this is another thing we've been working on there for, it's been about 2.5 years, with our ice cream supplier, who's a company called Lakenham Creamery. It takes forever because we've tried everything. We freeze dried and powdered buns and stirred that through an ice cream custard. That was, you know, kind of nice. We didn't get it quite right, and then we looked at deconstructing, sort of on paper, what the flavours inherent in a Chelsea bun were. How do you get the flavour of baked goods into ice cream to begin with? And what are the predominant flavours in the flavour profile of a bun, and then work them back in. We worked for a long time with the we strained some of the raisins that came out of the Chelsea bun syrup after we'd made the buns, and used those as the flavouring ingredient. We used a lot of bun syrup in different consistencies, but in the end we got it right.
And Tim, the smoked salmon on—is that something you smoke yourself? I think
we have a smoker set up so we can do sort of 36 sides at a time, they're smoked over Cambridgeshire applewood because we've always got a couple of apple trees coming down, and it's a lovely smoked flavour. I suppose the other trade secret is that smoked salmon is cured first in a mixture of salt and sugar. And so we use salt, which is fine, but we use bun syrup as the sugar component. And so Fitzbillies smoked salmon is actually cured in bun syrup.
So Chelsea buns find their way into ice cream and smoked salmon too.
Yes, amazing, really. And we'll have a few more ideas of what we can all do to reduce waste shortly.
Yes, and that music signals time for the latest food tweets from the city.
The Oak Bistro have tweeted a nice photo of a new item on the menu, rocket pesto linguine with sun-dried tomato and parmesan shavings, which I think makes us feel warm. And if you really need to get warm, if you're feeling chilly in the city centre, Bridges on Bridge Street have tweeted a picture of some nice hot soup which you can eat in or take away. A Romy in Bennett Street has a new sweet on the menu, crostatina with Sicilian wild berry jam and some nice looking lattice pastry as well. And although it's not been tweeting, on the Sunday market is the stall selling Italian sour cherry jam. It will be back, that's Il Mulino. And Calverley's Brewery is open. They have a variety of beers, including an 8.5% farmhouse IPA. They're open now with food from Pizza Mondo. Well, food is pretty miraculous. It doesn't only keep us alive and in good health, it's a means of socialising too, meeting friends in restaurants and cafes, parents preparing food with their children, all helping with relationships and mental health. And your physical health can be helped through growing stuff outdoors as well. But food has its negative aspects. Production and transport's effect on global warming, soil degradation through poor farming practices, the effect of pulling down forests to produce more palm oil or beef cattle, and the effect of unhealthy eating. So it's not surprising that local councils have food policies. In Cambridge, the City Council has been helped in its food policy by the work of Cambridge Sustainable Food. And I met Councillor Katie Thornborough, Labour Councillor in Trumpington, and she told me some of what's being done currently and what she would like to see happen in the near future.
There are cookery courses which are run in areas of poverty, and they're generally a 6 to 10 week course where locally sourced food is brought in and we teach people how to cook, but it brings people in from the community and it builds skills, it builds knowledge about food, and it also brings people together in the activity of cooking. And this has been been very successful, so much so that some of the people who have come to attend the courses have actually been taught how to run the courses themselves, so they're continuing to do it as a community event rather than something provided by the council.
The idea behind that is to help people to be able to cook food from, you know, the raw materials rather than using processed food.
Yes, and that teaches people about nutrition, it teaches people about where things are grown, how we produce food. It involves actually cooking skills, because it's now cooking is not actually on the curriculum, the school curriculum, and it's surprising how distant some people are from knowing where the basis of what food is, where it comes from.
Right. So have you got any examples of that?
Well, I have friends who won't cook with meat which looks like an animal. And it means that the children do not relate what they're actually eating with either an animal.
Right. So they wouldn't cook a chicken leg, because you can see that it's a leg.
Yes, yes. That's the same, and they would only cook with mince as a form of beef.
So it resembles no part. And you say it's been a success, what, the attendance has been good? Has anybody followed up whether the people have moved away from processed foods? I mean, perhaps not in entirety, but...
I've attended a couple of the classes in the courses, and it's all vegetarian-based, and it's been really well received, and people have gone away and have tried things out between the classes and continue to try and buy food from markets and not buy packaged vegetables even, you know, buy loose vegetables and vegetables that are grown locally, you know, wonky vegetables as well. And they've come back and with their experiences of what they've done at home. As well as working with young people, the courses have been run for older people as well, because these days there are quite a few older people who are quite lonely, and bringing people together to cook is a great way to bring them back into the community.
And how did your interest in food develop? What brought that about?
So I had some time off to do a master's degree in food policy at City University, and that has been an eye-opener for me. And it's motivated me to become much more active in local politics and looking at how we can get better food for everyone.
Mm, right. Were there any sort of particular points that stood out from that that had an impact on you?
Well, one thing is, it seems to be that there are quite a lot of lessons and examples about how we can turn around food production, which seems to get lost. So, for example, after the Second World War, we know that the population here in the UK was the most healthy. The poorest people were as healthy, more healthy than they'd ever been, and also the richer people were more healthy. We had so much information there, I feel that we could have utilised more in government policy. But I think what's happened is the pressures for globalisation has taken over and led development about how food is produced and provided for people. And I think some of the lessons we learned then are still relevant, and I think we could review them.
Wasn't there more advice then as well on healthy eating? Although there is government advice available, it doesn't sort of permeate, does it?
No, it doesn't permeate, and yes, I think that we're not really food literate as we were in the past. I think we people were much more hands-on growing and learning from each other, from our parents and grandparents, and it was a community activity. And I think I'm very keen to have more allotments and community gardens now to help bring communities together and people together. And And also for health, it's really great to get out and be in the open more and be more attached and aware of what's happening in nature. We know it helps to de-stress people. It helps with the pressures of modern life to be out in amongst nature and greenery.
Mm. There aren't a lot of allotments available. There tends to be long waiting lists.
Some of the allotments in Cambridge now, I think, have very short waiting lists, depending... Empty Common has got the highest waiting list, and there are other areas where there are lower waiting lists. Cambridge City does have a policy to provide new allotments for areas of high development, and some of them have been handed over recently. The Eddington development has an allotment. There's Nine Wells development, which is in the southern fringe, is that allotment will be handed over soon. And then there are three more allotments in the southern fringes, two which I'm hopeful will be handed over very soon, and a third one, there's still some complicated paperwork which needs resolving. Also in Trumpington, there are going to be some roads handed over where there's these small pedestrian areas linking main roads, and they're formally planted. And I would like to trial with some residents who are interested in food to hand over these spaces, and actually, rather than having formal planting, enable residents to have micro community gardens, and as well, and see how that works, and maybe enable more of this to happen in the city. But there are also some larger community gardens which have been formed. So again, Empty Common has a very successful community garden, and there will be one in Clay Farm, which is in the middle of the new Trumpington area. Community gardens enable people to come out and be involved in gardening, but they can put in time here and then rather than having the responsibility of a piece of land to grow vegetables on and keep clear. So, and they will, in the community gardens, they run programs for children as well and enable events to be held to do with celebrating food through all of the seasons. I think it would be wonderful if every new house that was built or flat had enabled the residents to grow a percentage of their food. And as an architect, when I work with clients, I talk to them about being able to grow food. And I would like to call on all architects to actually bring in food, the opportunity to grow food, in the same way as architects talk to clients about how to make their buildings and settings sustainable.
Everyone has a place to keep their car, yes, but not to grow their food.
Yes.
Right, well, thanks very much, Katie.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And that was Councillor Katie Thornborough with some really fantastic ideas, I thought.
It's not just the council that's trying to sort out problems relating to food. There are many organisations doing their bit too. And Flavour recently reported that Calvary's Brewery in Hooper Street, they send their used barley to a local allotment as a soil improver. The brewer Toast, whose beers can be brought from independents as well as a couple of large supermarkets, they use their waste bread in its brewing process, and there is an awful lot of waste bread too. Sandwich producers, for example, they throw away the crusts, they make a big contribution to the 24 million wasted slices a day. Producing each bottle of Toast beers uses a slice, and they have produced 265 million litres in six countries so far. Food Cycle in Cambridge and other cities uses food that donors would otherwise throw away to make meals for anyone to enjoy.
Katie talked there about the benefits of cookery classes. And coming shortly to Cambridge, there are some baking classes for toddlers. They're being run by Karen Allworth, and she told me why it's important for children to cook.
I set up Always Time to Bake 5 or 6 years ago because I found that children had no idea about food provenance, how to cook. And when I delved a little deeper into that, I realised the parents, who are obviously in their 20s, 30s, they also couldn't cook. So there's a massive sort of gap with probably in their education. And I started giving very, very informal classes in their homes or, you know, birthday parties as well. And it's just grown from there, really. And now I do, my most popular classes now are toddler and parent or guardian classes, which we call Big Chef, Little Chef, and basically you cook along with your child. I would say that the parents learn as much as the children. So, definitely worthwhile.
You've been running these in Northamptonshire, and
in London as well, and now you're wanting to start in Cambridge.
Set up in Cambridge, yeah. It's not far from Northamptonshire, so it's very commutable for me, and that's what I'm hoping to do. And then we'll go on to after-school clubs for older children, but at the moment it would just be preschool.
And you're hoping that the classes may be based in Trumpington?
Trumpington Village Hall, so it's very and easy to find, I would think.
What types of dishes have children made and parents made at your classes in the past?
So this week's menu is we are doing a fish pie using phyllo pastry. The children will make their own little cream cheese filling using, I decided it would be quite Mediterranean, so it was herbs and lemon, garlic, onion. So they do that, they taste it, I want them to taste it. And then we basically spread our white fish with that, and we put it in phyllo, which is another ingredient which is loads of fun, not that familiar to many people, and so instantly they're interested. They don't believe it's pastry. They do that, and then we just serve that with various veggie fries, try and get some vegetables into them. And then we made a pear and chocolate, well, it was like a massive brownie actually, so it's just a squidgy pudding. But I try to get food and veg into each course, but I'm very aware that if I make it so healthy that, you know, even you and I might think twice, they're not going to look at it. So I try to make it fun, tasty and healthy.
That sounds really, really nice, actually.
Yes. It was really nice. I had it yesterday.
So how long do the classes actually last for?
The Big Chef, Little Chef, or an hour to an hour and a half, and usually I do hold their attention for a good hour, hour and a quarter. The older children, it's anything from 2.5 to 5 or 6 hours. We have long, day-long workshops where we do massive projects. The Big Chef, Little Chef will be £12.50, and so that's an hour and a half, and you get three courses and tuition. So
you have not found anything comparable in Cambridge at all?
I haven't found anything that's doing parent and child cooking. I'm not saying that there's no children's cooking classes. I'm sure there are, although they don't seem to be as popular as you would think. And certainly not in London, certainly not in Northamptonshire, not where it's parent and toddler. So I feel it's quite a niche area.
And also, what about half-term and summer holiday and spring holiday?
I do lots of workshops. I haven't set those up in Cambridge yet. I do those at my home, which is, I know, a little bit far for Cambridge. But if it goes well in Cambridge at Trumpington on Thursday mornings, then definitely I would look into starting up in the holidays and also doing after school.
What's your background? Have you got a foodie background? Or
well, I just love food. I'm not. I've worked as a nanny, and I saw this sort of disconnection between food and, you know, being able to cook. I'm assuming it partly comes from not being it being in the on the school syllabus anymore. But people just aren't interested because they can go to the supermarket and buy loads of convenience food or pre-prepared vegetables. They just aren't interested. Some are, but it's a very small percentage of people who are. So I just decided that I just want to get the word out there. And of course now it's really popular. Everyone's talking about it with the obesity crisis and everything. And people need to learn to cook. It shouldn't be a luxury. It should be a life skill. So that's why. And I'm passionate about it, getting it out there. Just
if people want to know a little bit more about how to sign up for a class or a bit more about you, do you have a website?
I have a website, alwaystimetobake.com. That's all lowercase. And then Facebook, Always Time to Bake. Instagram, I think the same.
People can get your phone number and your email.
That's all on Facebook and all on my website, yeah.
Okay, sounds great. We look forward to seeing more of you in Cambridge.
Thank you.
And just to repeat those website details again, it's alwaystimetobake.com. That is all one word.
Can either of you remember the first thing you cooked and how old you were?
Does it count as cooking? When I was 6, I demanded for my mum to teach me how to make tea. Because as a child, I was sick of going around my friends' houses and all the parents going, oh, would you like some lemonade? Would you like some orange juice? No, tea. I just really fancy a tea, please.
I think you were very advanced, Mum.
Very sweet.
If anyone listening remembers when and what they first cooked, text us on 07919 070 490.
I'm free.
Back to reducing food waste again. Here's news of some free food available now in Cambridge and South Cambridgeshire, which you can find on the Olio app.
Yes, Jane Hashi has two New Yorker-style sandwiches on rye available. She's based just off Coleridge Road, and just some examples of other things that have just gone include Romanesco cauliflower, bags of quinoa, bulgur wheat, butter beans and green salad, and sweet things, of course, let's not forget them, such as packs of apricot and almond croissants. It's usually a little quieter over the weekend than the weekdays. That's the activity on the Olio app, and Olio is free on your Android or iOS phone, offering free food for pickup and, most importantly, keeping it out of that landfill.
In November 2017, we ran a feature called Root to Shoot, and it was about eating parts of plants which are often thrown away, but which are really good to eat. And in the continuing spirit of reducing food waste and of good eating, here's a small part of it. You can hear the whole thing on the podcast from the Cambridge 105 radio website. It was posted on the 15th of November 2017, and I think it was called The Great British Bake Off. The first voice is Simon Steele from the Sunday Market in Cambridge, then Maurizio Apollonio from Maurizio's in Mill Road, and finally allotmenteer Kim Benn from Grantchester. Simon, do you sell any unusual parts of vegetables?
Yeah, we sell quite a few sprout tops and the tops of celeriac plants, which are a really nice, strong flavouring top, and Hamburg parsley roots.
The roots of the parsley?
Yes, it's a root that's grown for flavouring during the winter.
And the celeriac tops, I mean, it shows that celeriac is very similar to celery.
It is, but the actual tops themselves are very strongly flavoured, and they're very good for flavouring soups and casseroles, but you can't eat it as you would like a celery stalk. It's very, very strong.
What, just unpleasant?
It's unpleasant, and it's not very good for your stomach if you have too much at once.
Right, but good added
but
to
good as a flavour.
Yeah.
And enhancer.
And do you sell turnip tops?
We do occasionally. We struggle to grow them very well, but we do sell them, particularly for the Italian customers who like them very much.
How long have you been selling these things for? Have they become sort of
on
popular?
The market now for about 17 years.
And do they sell well?
They do. They're increasingly selling well. When we first started selling sprout tops, we sold very few, but now they're becoming more and more popular as people appreciate them more.
Maurizio Apollonio of Maurizio Dining & Co. in Mill Road is a big fan.
Turnip top is an amazing, it's a very, very bitter vegetable and grows in the south of Italy. So, and I normally jump in the pan with a bit of garlic and olive oil.
And it's popular?
It's very, very popular.
You can try Maurizio's turnip tops at his restaurant at 44 Mill Road. Turnip tops can be sautéed with oil and garlic, or dressed, for example, with oil and lemon juice.
Chard stalks, if you get the lovely rainbow chard, you can get all sorts of beautiful different colour yellows and reds. And if you make a soup with chard, or you add it to a stew or anything like that, as a garnish, you can just cut up very, very small the stalks and just sprinkle them on the top. A, they're quite crunchy and delicious, and also they look very attractive.
All right, so they add a bit of texture as well as colour.
And definitely with a soup, if you've pureed the soup, then you can just sprinkle them on like croutons almost, or mix them with croutons, and they look really good. Just recently, in fact last year, I discovered broad bean tops. If you put your broad beans in the autumn, by the spring they're quite tall, and if you just pinch out the tops of the new leaves, they're very sweet and tender, and you can either mix them in a salad raw, or you can make a vinaigrette and mix them and have them as a sort of a side dish. You're also doing your plant quite a good turn as well, because it's the sweet tops that the blackfly love. If you pinch them out before they get them, then you can eat them before they do.
And what do they taste like? Broad beans?
They taste like broad beans. It's the same when you eat pea shoots. They taste like peas. These taste like broad beans. They're really quite delicious.
There's a feature in Saturday's Guardian Feast magazine about using up bits of food that might otherwise be binned. And this week, in fact, it's toast, with a burnt toast sorbet, combining it with oats, and also a lovely chestnut-based soup.
Now, Katie Thornborough was on earlier talking about the benefits of growing your own food and how she wants to make more spaces available for people to do that. But not everybody has the know-how. So, who better to ask than Dave Fox?
I mean, I'm pretty much a no-dig gardener these days, but I think an initial dig over to get those perennial roots out is a good idea. You'll never get them all out. You'll certainly never get them all out on the first pass, so go over it again. I would hand dig. I would not recommend the use of a rotavator. The reason, a lot of people do think that's the way to start, but unfortunately what that does is it chops up the pernicious weed roots. So here it's bindweed. On other sites, maybe other weeds would be the predominant ones, but if you chop those things up, then they'll regrow.
So you've got lots of little bindweed plants.
Pick it out, make sure it gets dried out and killed off and doesn't regrow. But hopefully after that process, you've then got a reasonably weed-free fine tilth. It always says on the seed packet, sow into a fine tilth. And we're aiming to get there when the soil started to warm up, so April. Probably April and May are the best times for sowing. At that point, I would suggest starting with some of the relatively easier crops. So don't start trying to grow, cauliflower or celeriac, because they're both a bit more demanding. Obvious ones I would say are early potatoes, broad beans, runner beans, tomatoes, lettuce, radish. So there's six things to start with at least, although of course even more important than that actually is to decide what it is you like to eat. Strawberries as well, who could forget strawberries?
Right,
get some strawberries in there, easy peasy. Although you need to plan ahead for strawberries, because ideally they would go in autumn and August, September, and then get strong over winter, get their cold dormancy period, which is what provokes them into producing flowers and fruit the next summer, and then you have strawberries next June and July.
Yeah, right, so between now and, say, April, you're digging, you're getting rid of roots, and some of the roots will be quite deep, will they?
Yes.
Okay, so how far down might they be? You know, things like bindweed.
Bindweed goes all the way down to hell.
You spend up until April doing your digging, but you're also thinking about what you're going to grow and, I suppose, where you're going to put it.
Absolutely, yeah. So I would divide your plot up into several distinct sections where you're going to grow different types of crops, that is, plants in different families, because the following year you want to avoid planting the same type of crop in the same place. You want to practice a rotation system.
And that's partly because of soil nutrient depletion and...
And also disease build-up, exactly, those two things, yeah.
Yeah.
So the way to do that is to get, where is it now? That's a half centimetre squared grid. You could sketch out your plot on a grid, do it to scale, so measure your plot out. I just use a full pace to represent a metre, which is close enough. And then divide it into beds, allow paths that are, you know, wide enough for you to walk down. If you've got someone who's a bit less mobile, or even a wheelchair user, that's going to influence the width of your paths. So I would say paths maybe at least 40 centimetres wide, perhaps even wider. And then dedicate one bed to potatoes, another bed to beans, another bed to brassicas would be the third type, and then everything else would be the fourth.
But brassicas are a bit more tricky, and you might not want to start with them. Well, you mentioned cauliflowers anyway.
Cauliflowers are tricky, but so other brassicas are much easier. So I certainly wouldn't want to discourage anyone from growing kale, for example. It doesn't get pest damage to the extent that other overwintering brassicas like broccoli do, for example. So then you've got a sketch map of what's going where, and you can proceed on that basis. Another thing to mention is don't sow everything all at once. So if you're growing broad beans, then split the packet of seed into two, sow a row or a bed or a square bedful, and then sow another one a month later, just in case the first lot fail for some reason. And in any case, if both of them work, then you've got a succession of crops, which is better. So a farmer, by contrast, or a conventional farmer at least, wants an enormous field of a crop to mature all at the same time so it can be processed by machine. You don't want that as a home grower. You want a succession of harvests so you can enjoy the crop for several months, perhaps.
I suppose it's terribly variable, but what's the level of nutrients in the soil if you're taking something over? Will you have to fertilise it before you start?
The primary indicator probably is the weeds. So if when you take the plot on, the weeds are growing well, then that shows there's plenty of nutrient in there. If there's a lot of nettle growing there, that shows it's probably quite high in nitrogen. That's a good sign, although the nettle's quite hard to eradicate.
So. Yeah.
So I'm not a great expert on nutrient. I don't know much that can't be cured by applying a large amount of well-rotted horse manure or a large amount of well-homemade compost.
Yeah.
Either of these things are going to provide a full spectrum of nutrients.
And are there any plants that are averse to that? Because it's quite strong stuff, isn't it, manure?
Yes, it is, and especially if it's not really well rotted. I mean, fresh manure is obviously pretty unpleasant stuff. You don't want to handle it, and it's possibly got pathogens in that won't be present in the well-rotted version. Yeah. So Trumpington Allotments gets its manure from the Shetland Pony Welfare Trust.
Are they local?
They're local enough to deliver it to us. But the only thing to say about that is get your order in early, because come Easter and afterwards they're massively booked up.
Yeah.
They have a top quality product. The great thing about their manure is that they know it's not contaminated by that horrible herbicide that we got hit with a few years back.
And also, can't you get well-rotted ex-green bin refuse?
Yes, you can, from Amy Cesper at Waterbeach. That's the recycling facility that, certainly from Cambridge and South Cambridgeshire, all our curbside collection of green waste goes to get chopped up and composted at a very high temperature, which of course kills pathogens and hopefully most weed seeds.
And is it costly?
It's free if you go and collect it. You can also, if you want lots, you could get some delivered, but I think you have to pay for that. The most convenient way I've found was to buy for £2.50 a sealed bag of the stuff. It was maybe only 40 litres or so, but I thought for £2.50 that was a jolly good deal, certainly cheaper than commercial composts.
Yeah.
And that comes from the household waste recycling centres. There's one at Milton and the other is at Triplow. Although this curbside product is not really a compost as such, because most of the nutrient value has been lost in the composting process. It's more, they call it a soil conditioner. It's the black stuff. If you've got, like we have at Trumpington, a quite a sandy soil, then adding this organic matter has got to be a good move, because that's going to improve the moisture retention, which is what you want if the soil's naturally dry.
Mm. Dave Fox from Trumpington Allotments in Foster Road. And Dave often runs well-attended workshops that help people to get started, and let's hope he runs a few again this year.
And there's Green Onions signalling the start of our news section, and we begin as ever with jobs.
Alex Rushmer and Lawrence Butler's new restaurant, Vanderlyle, which will open in Mill Road this spring, want staff. Send a CV and a few words on why you'd be a great fit with them to Sam at vanderlyle-restaurant.com. Their website is a place where you can sign up for future info about the restaurant. And there are vacancies for weekend counter staff at Fitzbillies. Pop in with your CV or email it to manager@fitzbillies.com or phone Cambridge 352 500 for more details.
And as promised earlier, here is some info about this summer's Eat Cambridge Food and Drink Festival. The dates are Saturday the 11th of May to Sunday the 26th of May, where the main event being on Saturday the 11th. Now, this will run from 10:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Guild Hall, and stalls are currently being confirmed and will include more than 35 food and drink stalls from the local area, with some exciting newbies.
There'll also be an exciting and varied programme of fringe events, with some new ones including Restaurant 22 and a brand new beer event, a top secret pop-up shop showcasing local food and suppliers as well. Rosie Sykes has joined Heidi White as festival patron and will have some fantastic things going on as part of the festival this year. And Cambridge 105 Radio is the broadcast partner again, and Burwash Manor is sponsoring the festival. Marvellous.
The Queen's Head in Newton is restarting its Wednesday night street food events this week, with Steak and Honour on the 6th, Guerrilla Kitchen on the 13th, Cardona and Son Barbecue on the 20th, and Mr. and Mrs. Fitz promising a fab food adventure on the 27th. They're all from 6 p.m. until about 8:30.
Very nice looking Valentine's menu at Onnie's in Mill Road. Bookings now being taken. Three courses for £20. Book via their website or email bookings@onnies.co.uk.
And if you've noticed the refitting at Jack's Gelato in Bennett Street and wondered what it's all about, the counter has been rearranged to speed up service. The idea is that you place your order at the window at busy times, you pick up your ice creams inside. Should lead to shorter queues.
On 26th of February at the Blue Moon in Norfolk Street, Skeptics in the Pub present Giles Yeo, who'll be talking about his book Gene Eating, The Science of Obesity and the Truth About Diets. It's at 7:30, it costs £5 for non-members, £3 for members. You can book online at Cambridge Skeptics.
And finally, there is a new cafe that's opened up on 164 Mill Road, just over the bridge. It's called Bravo Patisserie. Run by a Turkish family, it is packed with larger-than-life cake servings, Turkish flatbreads, kadayifs, baklavas and bulbuls. Plenty of pistachio, walnuts, hazelnuts, almond and honey, and lots of paper-thin sweet pastry papers.
And that's all that we have time for today. We're here on alternate Saturdays at 1 p.m, repeated on Sunday at 2 p.m, then podcast early next week. And coming up next on Cambridge 105 Radio is Women Making Waves, 3 o'clock Cambridge Wish List with MP Chris Smith, 4 this week, 5 the Cambridge Football Results Show, 6 Chris Brown Soul and Dance Show, 8 Centuries of Sound, and at 9 Paul Cristoforo with some musicians. That's all we have time for today. We'll be back on the 16th of February. So until then, goodbye.